Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm talking to writer-director Tyler Russell about his latest film, Cyst, which is a fun throwback to the monster movies of the early 60s. Over the course of the interview, I chat to Tyler about what inspired him to move into horror for the first time, and how he assembled his cast of cult genre stars, including The Room's Greg Sestero, Troll 2's George Hardy, and Lexi's Eva Haberman. Plus, we talk about why he filmed it in Baltimore instead of his usual Texas base, how he tried to get John Waters into the film, and how they made the look of the Cyst monster itself. All of which, and much, much more, you can hear right now in my interview with Tyler. Hi, Tyler. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hello, Scott.
So we've got you on the show today to talk about your film, Cyst. Can you give us a brief spoiler-free synopsis of Cyst?
Yes, it is the 60s, crazy... Oh man, spoiler free. A cis monster goes crazy and they're all trapped in an old hospital in the 60s. That's it. That's the spoiler free version of that movie.
Now, fun.
What's your spoiler free one?
The spoiler free one. Yeah, okay. So, yeah.
See, it's hard to do.
Yeah, no, it's true. You could still mention the laser, like a malfunctioning laser creates a cyst monster who goes on the rampage.
There you go.
So you've got for the listener, you now have two spoiler free synopsises for you. So pick your own adventure. Which one did you like best? So I was looking at your filmography. It seems like quite a different film for you. You've done some comedy, like crime. It seems like a lot of your films are kind of slices of Americana, and this is a horror flick. It seems new for you. Why did you decide to do a horror flick?
Wanted to do something different. I think you get burned out on movies really quick. You basically like spend 2 years of your life with a movie. Even if you're working on something else, you're still working on it, you're still taking care of it, you're still updating things, you're still responding to people, making sure, you know, it's a business. It's still gonna sit there. It's kind of like owning a house. The house can't just sit there. It's gotta have electricity or it's gonna rot. You know, there's a lot of time and care goes into it. So, I did a comedy first, and then did, like you said, a crime kind of Texas noir film. And then just to try something different, I really enjoyed working with George Hardy and a lot of those guys, and they're all in the horror genre. And so it made sense to make something kind of fun in the horror genre. We were talking with Eva Haberman and she wanted to do something with us, and we kind of came together, put our heads together, and this was like, I gave a whole bunch of ideas, and this was at the bottom of the list. And this was the one that everybody wanted to do, and it turned into something really, really fun. And that's kind of like when you have a good team around you, you know, you bounce off ideas and you bounce off things and you turn into something really special. And I think this movie does have a lot of special moments in it. And it's a really good piece of like cult cinema that people who maybe aren't into horror films will enjoy. And that's why I enjoy it. It's not just like a gross out comedy horror. There's a lot to it. There's some heart. There's some scariness. There's some good practical effects. You know, there's a lot of fun stuff in it. So that was really interesting. It was my first time dealing with all those practical effects, and it was a lot of fun.
So the project came out of Eva Habermann approaching you first.
Yeah, I think it was a combination of both of us, because I had met her before, and George and her had worked together on Under Control, which is a fun film if you haven't seen that yet. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's kind of like a homage to Troll 2 with a lot of German influence behind it. And it's a whole heck of a lot of fun. And I had worked with her on doing the English ADR for that movie. And we just had a blast doing it. And her and George got along really well. And yeah, it kind of put our heads together and said, you know, how can we make something really fun and make it make sense to have this German actress, you know, and George in there too. Well, George is a dentist in real life. And, you know, Eva's got that sweet and spunk to her. So yeah, it just made a lot of sense, kind of like how everything came together.
And George was in your other two features as well. How did that relationship start?
I met George for the first time on Here Comes Rusty's, the first film. He came in for one day to do a cameo role, and we were shooting in Alabama, and just kind of reached out to him on Facebook, and he came for the day, and we had a ton of fun. Everybody loved him. Everybody loved his attitude. He's a really positive guy. And so after we did the film, we played the film at a film festival in Alabama, and I had like went out there and hung out with him. And I was like, God, this guy's a lot of fun. He really cares. Why wouldn't you want to spend, you know, a month on a set with this guy being your lead actor? You know, he's really talented. And so, yeah, so I wrote a script for him, and he fell asleep in the first like 10 pages of reading the script. And I was like, all right, this is going to be good. It's going to be great. But no, George, he's just a really great guy to be around. And I think, especially when you watch movies like Troll 2 and you see him act, you're like, I wish this guy had more to work with, and maybe there would have been something for him, you know? And I think that's a lot of actors, you know, they just sit at the right place at the right time, the right opportunity. Sometimes they get roles that they just don't make sense for their style of acting or whatever it's going to be. So, yeah, I think it just made a lot of sense to try it. And we had a freaking blast. And, yeah, George is like such a really positive person to be around on set. So that's why I wanted to do the next film with him. And I think that's where my style of filmmaking is. It's like, I want to work with people I enjoy to be around. And it's not about, you know, we're trying to make the biggest piece of art. I mean, maybe later down the line we can do something like that. But right now let's have fun. Let's enjoy it. Let's learn. Let's get better. Let's keep making movies. Let's not wait 5 years to make a movie. You know, it's better to have something than have nothing, I think.
Yeah, because I noticed that as well, that there's a few actors on this film that you'd worked with before, like George, like Gene Jones, like Jason Douglas. So it seems like you like that. You like working with the same, once you find actors that you jive with, that you like continuing that relationship.
Yes, yeah. And it helps a lot of things, especially in low budget independent films, you know, reaching out to somebody and their agent and going through that whole business, it's not a lot of fun. So when you work with somebody before, you know, it works, you have a role for them, you know what they're bringing, they know what they're coming to expect, you know, they're not going to have their own trailer. They're just going to come have a lot of fun. And, you know, that's all I can offer is a good time. And then hopefully they'll be proud of the film, and that's the way it's got to be. You know, you got to come, you got to believe in the project, and if it's not your type of project, you probably shouldn't do it. You really, shouldn't be doing it for the money. There's a lot of other things you can do to make money and not movies. You know, there's, yeah. So
I think that's one of it. Yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
I was just going to say, I think as one of the few things that I'm not a filmmaker. I don't understand the dilemmas of filmmaking, but that's one of the few things I do understand in terms of like talking to people's agents, because I have a much more successful strike rate in terms of people I have emailed directly as opposed to people I've tried to get on the podcast via an agent.
The loops and hurdles just to talk to them. Yes, yeah, it's crazy. I feel you though. I feel you, Scott. I feel you. Yeah. But you know what? You'd also be surprised too. There's a lot of people that you'd be really surprised that like they want to work, they want to hang out, they want to meet people. You have to earn that trust, just like with anything. These people have lives.
Yeah.
They have things they have to pay for, you know, they have a roof over their head. Like there's things you have to do for it to make sense. If they live down the road from you and you're not asking them to come travel across the country, whatever, then that's different. But it's a business, but it's also an art, and it's also you're doing it because you love what you're doing. So it's tricky, it's finicky, but you have to take the right steps for people to be comfortable to come do this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So like, you know, Gene Jones, you know, he wants to work. That guy would love to work. And if you just talk to him and he likes your script, he'll probably do your film. And then, you know, a lot of people can't believe that. They're like, oh my gosh, like it's Gene Jones. Well, Gene Jones is like you and me and everybody else. He wants to work. He wants to act. He wants to be around people. He loves it.
Yeah. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I was curious, like when George like auditioned for Here Comes Rusty, had you seen him previously in Troll 2? Were you aware of Troll 2 at that stage?
Yes. So I was a fan of Troll 2. I think I'd seen the documentary Best Worst Movie, right. But it was really my producer, Ross Smith. He was the one who really wanted to work with George. And he was like, we got to get George. And I was like, there's no way you're going to get him, because, you know, this is before talking with these actors and these agents and being a crew member on sets and not really understanding the way it works and being kind of scared to take those leaps and to just pick up the phone and call. I mean, like, that's a big, you know, it's a big step when you're just starting out, just saying like, here, I'm this person, you know, are you going to say no to me? It's scary. You don't want somebody to say no to you. And then, you know, it ruins your kind of like perspective of that actor. But he reached out to him before, and or he had reached out to like Mark Burchard and a lot of people. And so he kind of gave me the confidence to do that. And I think that's like a big step too, is like having those people around you that make you better, you know. That's a big thing, because it's your art, you know. You don't want it to be bad. You don't want anybody to get upset with you.
For sure. I get that. I was wondering as well, like, you know, you mentioned, you know, there's different things going on in the movie, and there's gore and there's goopiness and there's comedy and there's heart there as well. And I was wondering, just in terms of the casting, also like in the cast is Darren Ewing, who was also in Troll 2, and Greg Sestero, who is in The Room. Were you at all worried, like the fact that George in Troll 2 and you know, two Troll 2 actors, the actor from The Room, that people would be sniffy, that might think it was like kind of gimmicky stunt casting?
You know, people are going to say what they want to say. People are going to want to do what they want to do. I cannot control those people. The ones that loved The Room, the ones that love Troll 2, they're going to, I would think, they would appreciate, because I've been wanting to see them together since I've been watching movies. You know, like, I love cult films. I love these actors. I love who they are as people. I love who they are in front of the camera. I had met Darren before, and he was such a nice guy, and just had a blast with him as well. Greg, Travis had worked with Greg, my producer, and nothing but good things. And so it's like, why wouldn't we want to have them all together in a movie, you know, and try to make like not a bad film? We're not trying to make a bad film, you know. This isn't a gimmick. We're trying to make a really entertaining know, hour 20 minutes, or whatever it is. Yeah. You know, for people to take a break on their lives and watch this thing. If you don't like Troll 2 and you don't like The Room, you probably shouldn't watch this movie.
I get that for sure. No, I suppose, like, I was thinking, like, in terms of the concern of, like, people assuming that you are trying to make a bad movie, like a kind of like a Sharknado or something like that, you know what I mean? Whereas, absolutely. I mean, I know you're not. Absolutely. I mean, I've seen your movie and I know that it's just very different. You're not trying to make a bad movie. You're trying to make an entertaining movie that's done in a particular B-movie style. But I'm just putting out there, you know, about that possible assumption.
Oh, absolutely. I think, there's that's going to happen. It's going to happen. I mean, I enjoy reading a lot of the reviews and not on like CIS, on like my other movies too. Like as good as a high school film, you know, and I laugh at it. I love it. It's at least somebody watched it, you know, like that's all you can ask for is for somebody to actually watch what you did. So that in itself, even if people hate it, that's great though. They got through it. And I appreciate that because there's bajillions of other movies out there. But honestly, I'm not worried about people saying that we're trying to make a bad movie. It's like The Room. Right? People can think it's, you know, they did this on purpose. If they think that's crazy. It's like so much fun to watch. Like, and then you meet the people and you're like, these people are amazing. Like, but no, I totally get what you're saying. You can't. You're never going to win that battle. But that was not in the cards ever making this movie. We tried to make something with quality of what we were going for. If that answers your question. Very long answer. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. Quite happy to have a long answer. It's all right. Why did you decide to co-write the film with Andy Silverman? Like, what is that partnership come about?
Andy's a good friend of mine. He's very talented. He has great notes. He has great ideas. I really enjoy working with people. I like the team aspect. You know, making a film is never about one person, ever. Should never be about that because there's so many moving parts. So if you think your script is great and nobody should give you any ideas to change it, it's probably going to be terrible. So, you know, I like working with people. A lot of my scripts, I have somebody else with me. I just think it keeps you grounded and you hear different perspectives on different scenes. So you kind of know, is this what I'm going for? Is this, when they tell me this note, is that note right or wrong? Because I feel like this is what I'm trying to achieve with that scene or with that line. So that's why I like working with people on scripts. And Andy's awesome.
And from that initial script that you did, how long did it take from script into production into like shooting?
It was very fast. We probably had a very bad version of the script in the summer and we began shooting in either end of November or December. So it was super fast.
That's great.
For like having a script and setting everything up and hiring people and getting everything made, that's really, really fast. I don't remember the exact time we had it, but I mean, we had to switch states for this film. You know, like we were going to shoot it in Austin. We were going to shoot in Oklahoma. We ended up going to Baltimore.
Yeah. I was wondering, that was going to be one of my questions because like I was looking through your filmography and I realized that most of your films had been filmed in Texas. And I was wondering why you'd made the decision to film the film in Maryland and in Baltimore.
The decision to move there was in Austin, the place we wanted to shoot. The location was just too expensive. And then, you know, having to bring people into town, the hotels and stuff that we found were just out of the ballpark. We decided to look at Oklahoma because they had a really good tax incentive. And I think it's like 35-40% back, which is a lot. So if you put that into perspective of your low budget film, it could give you a couple of days. It could pay for extra stuff in post-production. It could be a lot of things that you need that money for because like, you know, every dollar counts. So yeah, we were going to go to Oklahoma. We had a location, we had everything kind of set up and ready to go. And then a big budget Matt Damon movie came in and basically took the entire crew in Oklahoma.
All right.
And so running out of time, called a guy I'd worked with before, and he helped us find some locations, and we just decided to move out there and go for it. And I crossed our fingers that the planes and stuff, you know, wouldn't freeze over trying to get out there in December. And it actually worked out pretty well.
And in terms of the shoot itself, how smooth did the shoot go?
So it was kind of built, like the whole movie was built for low budget. It's all in one location. We move out of the location to kind of to give some breath to the audience and to kind of get the atmosphere a little bit better. But that was kind of the thought of like, okay, let's try to shoot 80% of the movie in one location. And that's what we did. So we were trapped in this old, I think it was a bottle cap factory. And that's where we rented out the space and shot the whole movie there. And yeah, everything you can imagine on a low budget movie happened, where, you know, the toilets in the bathroom go out, so you got to rent porta potties, and, you know, there's gunshots behind the hotels, and it's just like Baltimore is a fun place. It's
before we started recording the podcast, because I'm from Scotland, you asked if I'd met Sean Connery. Since you were in Baltimore, did you meet John Waters?
Oh, no, but we actually reached out to him. He said no.
Did you? Oh, that's disappointing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't blame him, though. You know, he's John Waters.
I suppose he is. I mean, he's turned up in other things, you know. I wonder why. That's,
maybe it was called Cyst, and he's like, sounds gross.
Yeah, from the man who directed Pink Flamingos, you know, like, yeah, that's great. It's some gross shit over there. Oh dear. Oh well.
Yeah, maybe next time. Maybe Sis 2.
Well, it's like, yeah, I mean, we're kind of skimming ahead of ourselves, but you do leave the door open for a sequel.
Maybe we do.
I mean, possibly. It's possible, as you know, like, you know, when it came up the end, I was genuinely wondering if it was going to do the Flash Gordon thing where a question mark came up after, but
ooh, I might actually add that in there. Good idea. That's a good idea.
It's great. I like that. That's going to be my one contribution to cinema.
Yeah, there's definitely a possibility for Sis 2, Sister Act 2, Terror Cyst, Mary Systemus. I mean, there's a lot of different, you know, ways we could go with it. Yeah,
that's true. I was just starting to think of other sequel titles. So I like just it's Sis 2, Sis Harder.
Sister Act 2.
Yeah. Yes, anyway. we'll move on from that. I was wondering, in terms of before you started shooting the film, did you direct the actors to watch any certain films, like Roger Corman films or anything like that, ahead of the shoot, or do you just go in cold?
Well, so for the cast and crew, I set up, you know, everything from music to movies to watch to kind of the color palette and the clothes and things like that. So, you know, did they do it? Did they work on it? I don't know. And that's one of the things with low budget filmmaking is like, you can't expect these people to, if they don't want to put in that kind of work, they don't have to put in that kind of work. You just have to get them to do what you need to do on the day. And I know these guys well enough to know that they will, no matter what, get to that place we need them to be. And a lot of the roles are kind of written for them. So I'm not really too worried about that kind of stuff. And I also too didn't want them to get too tied into the like 60s and the 50s. because this is a modern film and our attention span is different. The way we take stuff in is different. I don't know if you've seen like Mank or, you know, these films that are trying to be straight up old school.
Yeah, I've watched it.
You know, there's a lot of people, like if you understand that kind of cinema, you get it. But for the majority of people, they're going to turn it off. That's just how it is. We, you know, we watch too many TikToks and things like that, where it's just 15 seconds and done. So you just have to know your audience. And that's my opinion on that.
Okay. No, I can definitely understand that take. But I was wondering, like, of the kind of suggested movies that you did suggest, what were some of the suggested movies?
Oh, boy. Let me think. Like Reanimator, The Thing. I'm just drawing a blank right now. I'm sorry. I definitely had like 10 films.
Okay. And
those are two big ones, though.
Reanimator and The Thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But they were, so it was things like that, kind of less 60s stuff. Was there 60s stuff in there as well?
Yeah. The Blob.
The original?
Yeah, I mean, both of them are great.
But, both of them are, you know, yeah. Like, yeah, both of them are great fun. I was just, yeah.
I just didn't want, again, I didn't want people to get tied up into 60s stuff. So I was trying to break that mold. But I think the original Blob was like the only one. But yeah, I'd have to go back and look at my list. Honestly, I'm sorry, I can't.
No, it's no problem at all. I was just asking out of curiosity. That's fine. I was also wondering, in terms of how you directed the actors, the movie, and this is not a kind of spoiler of any sorts. It's just kind of about the tone of the movie. So, like, obviously, there is a cis monster. Obviously, it's done in a kind of style that is a kind of pastiche of B movies, but the tone is, you know, possibly surprisingly straight. Did you direct all the actors in a certain way that you wanted them to, like, read it as if it was a serious movie?
Yeah, definitely. I think when you try to get them to be like slapsticky and goofy, it's just never going to come off right. So they have to believe what's happening is real for these jokes and these payoffs to happen. The audience has to believe that they're in danger, that they think they're in danger for them to even care about the characters. So let's just say if anybody in this film dies, heaven forbid, you want them to feel something, right? Either like, yes, I'm glad that guy died, or, oh no, I love that character. So yeah, it was not supposed to be super slapsticky Three Stooges kind of comedy.
Again, do you feel like that might come as a surprise to audiences? You know, just in they just hear the concept of the movie and they just picture a certain thing.
Well, maybe if they see like the trailer and things like that, maybe they could think it's going to be like, oh my gosh, this is going to be a gore fest. Which there's some gore in it, but like that's not like the main focus of the film. I think there's enough layers in this film for somebody to get, like, everybody to get something different out of it. I think there's some replay value also in it, which is fun. You can still have fun watching the film and finding something else, because, you know, the actors, they carry it really well. They all, if you decide, okay, I'm gonna watch this again and watch that person in the background, they're gonna bring something different to the scene. So yeah, I think there's enough in there, and there's a lot, and it's a good time at the home cinema.
And talking about something that's a good time for the viewer, but possibly not for the actors, is the there is a lot of people who get covered in a lot of different substances, various goop and goo and blood and various things. How was that for the actors? I'm particularly thinking of Eva. Like, how did she take all that?
A lot of actors got covered with a lot of different things, but for the most part, I think everybody was just having fun and they enjoyed it. I think everybody was like, this is kind of fun. I feel like a little kid, you know, having this happen. Besides, you know, all of Eva's stuff, because she gets covered in stuff all the time. So yeah, but she is such a good sport, such a really talented actress. She knew it was coming and she took it really well. And yeah, I don't know if I would like to get sprayed like 10 times in a row, but she definitely took it all the way. And yeah, just my hat, it was off to her like every day, because she'd still have a smile on her face with all the goop all over her body. Just like, okay, what's next? And I'm like, I think we're out of goo. Sorry.
How were those scenes to stage? Because obviously, you know, like getting it just right.
There's a lot of anticipation for it when you're doing the practical effects, because number one, you're going to spray somebody with stuff and then there's no way to clean it. You don't have time to like reset. So it's got to be perfect. And yeah, things went wrong all the time. But we knew it was going to happen and we adjusted with it. And that's just part of it. It's like the special effects team was so good that we trusted them with everything. And every time we had an idea, they would do it. Or if we wanted to change it, they could adjust it really easily. And you just got to be ready. And hopefully, you know, it's in focus and hopefully the actor's going to be ready. And we got really lucky with a lot of that stuff.
I was also wondering in terms of like the big cyst monster, like how closely did you collaborate with the special effects team in terms of the design, or did you just let them do their own thing, or did you give them kind of specifics of what you wanted?
In the beginning, we had ideas of what we wanted and we had the effects that we wanted to do, but we had no idea how to pull them off. When we talked to Tolan Effects, the team that did all the effects, basically like every time we would tell them an idea, they're like, oh yeah, we can do that. What's next? And they're like, okay, here's another one. They're like, yep, okay. Anything else? Like basically they had done everything or knew how to do every effect that we had, and they were genuinely excited about it. So yeah, I think once you find people that know what they're doing, that they're confident in what they're doing, and they show you this is what we're doing, then yeah, the confidence grows and the trust grows, and you let them kind of run off and do what they need to do. And that was definitely a lot of it. They had an idea, we said yes, and it pulled it 100% was a, you know, big payoff for letting them do that. So yeah, it's, I would give them all the credit for the special effects stuff.
Excellent. And yeah, how effective was it kind of on set? Like did the cyst monster break down much, or was it pretty good?
It was really good, really solid. All of the well, I can't give it away too much, but yeah, the creature in all of its different forms, 100%. Really, really fun watching a massive, like, you know, 7-foot cyst monster walking down the hall.
So you were mentioning as well that like the film has kind of some like rewatch value in terms of like kind of picking out different characters, and also like one of the things is, like a lot of B movies, even back in the day, the film does seem to sneak in some serious themes in there, particularly surrounding gender politics and the kind of underappreciated woman who's effectively being abused by her boss.
Yes, yeah, that's definitely the main one in this film, for sure, is toxic masculinity. Especially, I mean, if you go watch almost any 50s, 60s movie, you're just like, this doesn't make any sense. And it still happens today in movies where you're just like, God, like, have these people ever talked to a woman before? Like, what are they doing?
Yeah, so no, that's unbelievable.
So we worked, you know, closely with Eva on that, and she always had good ideas of how to like up her character and what she kind of wanted to say, and even just the small moments that are in the film, you know, it just adds so much. But it's got to be believable, you know. And so that's what we wanted. It's to take that old school, you know, 50s, 60s movie spin and put it in kind of a, you know, 2020 way, to say like, this is the way, you know, these women are going to stand up for themselves. And, you know, Eva's basically running the whole place, like all the operations, and this guy's a goof, and you know, I think it turns out for the best for in the film.
Yeah, Yeah. I got again without giving any spoilers, but yes, absolutely. it does seem to be something that I've noticed particularly being explored a lot in horror recently. Like the theme of toxic masculinity in various different horror films that I've talked to the directors on this podcast are exploring this issue, male directors. So it does seem to be, you know, on people's minds. And I was wondering why you think that horror seems to be one of the best conduits to kind of tackle that subject, because like I'm not seeing it a lot in other genres, but I'm seeing it a lot in horror in recent years, in the last kind of couple of years.
Well, I mean, I would say it is like being in a horror movie when you're treated like that. It's terrible. Guys and girls, whenever your boss or your partner or whoever is taking total advantage of you, it's terrible. So yeah, I mean, I've worked on, I have no idea how many numbers of film gigs, and different crews and people like that. And it could be anybody from the people from out of town that treat you terrible, or it could be the gender, it could be anything. They just don't like the way you look, they don't like the way you talk, but there's just like no excuse for it. And that's kind of, you know, like no matter what position you're in, you're all equal. And yeah, there's like, you know, there's the way that things go, and you know, in a job, and but there's no excuse for that crap. So I think it's, yeah, it's we looked at a lot of different ways somebody can be toxic and try to put them into the film. Are they, you know, not listening to them or not thinking them or just making them do stuff because they don't want to do it? And I mean, there's a lot of like really much deeper layers. I don't want to get into it and ruin the movie, but yeah, there's a lot in this film.
Yeah, I absolutely. And like you say, yeah, that's something that, you know, you saw a lot back in the day, but not something that you still hear about now. I mean, certainly pertaining to horror. I mean, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to get myself sued or anything, but obviously the CineState stuff that blew up last year, you know, that whole story.
Oh, I don't even know what it was. But oh, okay. I mean, honestly, I mean, there's stuff like every day that comes up.
Yeah. It was like they owned like Fangoria and stuff like that. It was like a kind of Texan production company, and it was there was various allegations. But like,
a lot of stuff happening in the States right now.
Okay, but anyway, it was a story that blew up last year. It was I don't want to say too much about it, I feel like, on the podcast, because I don't.
Okay. I
don't want anybody. It's something that blew up last year. We'll move on. yes. So back to your movie. That's kind of thrown me for some reason. Yeah. So yes, in terms of like moving forward with your film, I was going to talk about like your festival run, and if your festival run was particularly curtailed or affected by COVID.
Yeah, it's been weird. Gosh, it's such a weird year for films that are trying to premiere. I mean, we got so lucky getting this film done in December. Because if it would have been January or February, there's no way we would have finished it. So it was all post-production during COVID, got the movie done, sent it out. And we had some really, really good, nice people that were helping us kind of get to festivals. And yeah, I mean, it's all virtual, but it's, at least it's getting seen, you know? I mean, that's just part of it. That's part of this year. I'm still processing kind of like what's been, like we haven't really had a, you know, showing this with film with people other than the people that worked on it from Texas. We had a small screening with like 10-15 people. I believe it played in Australia with 50 to 100 people, and somebody fainted in the movie. But everything else has been online, and it's kind of okay because you kind of hear directly from the people that watch it, and I enjoyed that a lot, like getting to talk to a lot of people from different parts of the world. But, you know, hey, the goal is for it to be somewhere where people can go click a button and watch it, right? That's the goal. And every business besides film festivals, we're trying to figure out a way to move forward. And, you know, thankfully, these film festivals have found a way to even get their event going through this, you know, so that right there is a victory. And of course, like any festival that wanted to play our film, we were just like, yes, take it, of course, because we're all in it together, man. If there weren't film festivals, no indie films would be able to get their word out. And really appreciative of the people that took our film.
Yeah. And in terms of like festivals here, you played at Fright Fest. Was that a festival that you were aware of?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a great festival. It's a big one, big genre festival, and a lot of really good people that run it. Yeah. Very, very, very happy to go there.
And the reaction that I saw on Twitter, cause I mean, that's, you know, your film first came on my radar when it played at Fright Fest in October. I didn't manage to see it at that time, but I saw it got a very positive reaction. How pleased were you with the reaction it got at Fright Fest?
Very, 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 very happy. It seemed like a lot of people understood what we were trying to do, and they enjoyed it, and they enjoyed the ensemble cult craziness that came out of it. So yeah, no, very, very happy. Yeah, could not be happier with the reactions, honestly. It's really funny hearing like people comparing it to different gross things. So yeah.
Yeah. Very yeah. Happy. It's by total coincidence, one of the last people I interviewed on the podcast were the writer and director of The Brain That Wouldn't Die remake, which is so I saw that recently, and I was just like, all right, I'm just going to interview people who are setting their films in the early 60s.
yeah, I want to see that. Oh my gosh.
Oh, it's good. It's a fun time, that movie. Yeah.
Oh man, so that one. Oh, that's awesome. I actually went to a comic book store, and the owner was like, "Oh, do you know this guy?" And he pulled up a card, and it was their movie, and I was like, "What? Small town Louisiana out of nowhere." So yeah, I gotta meet those guys. That's exciting. I want to see their film.
Yeah, they're really nice. I think you would enjoy it. It's a fun film as well, and it's kind of like, yeah, it also in a similar vein to your film, actually kind of adds more you know, kind of grist on the bone to the female characters, and has a bit of a kind of commentary on gender as well. So like yeah, there's definitely kind of connective tissue there.
Double feature.
Yeah, it would make a good double feature, absolutely. I would recommend any listener, when both films come out in the UK, I would recommend the Brain Wind Die remake and your film as a fun Saturday night double bill that can also make you think a little as well.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And I was also going to ask with in terms of distribution, can we see, I realized you were picked up by Raven Banner. Is there a release date on the horizon?
Yes, I believe very soon we will know, but all good things, all very, very good things. That's all the info I got for you.
All the info we got, people. Okay, that's all right. And so kind of rolling forward for you, do you think you'll make more horror movies? And you're obviously locked into making Sis 2 now, but you know, like what are you currently working on at the moment as well?
Working on a couple of things. It just kind of depends on COVID. I don't think, you know, after we had Sis, we were already kind of jumping to get another film going, and then it's just not the time right now to rush anything. It was a good lesson to learn, to calm down, to slow down, to enjoy what, you know, the positive things that come out of this crazy pandemic. And we're not going to put anybody in harm's way right now. We're going to wait. We're going to let things kind of fizzle out and hopefully get better. and then we'll move forward. But just working, writing, and developing stuff, it just depends on how, you know, moving forward, making films in the independent way is going to be. If it's that you can only have 10 people on a set, you know, then we got to figure out a movie like that. Or if it's like you can still get the normal amount, then you got to put the additional cost in there for all the COVID stuff. And that's a big chunk of change. So yeah, you just got to move forward the right, smart, safe way.
Yeah, I suppose it must be very difficult at the moment, you know, and being in accordance with social distancing rules and getting masks for everybody and, you know, having everything sanitized down all the time and like all that.
Yeah, it almost becomes more about keeping people safe than the actual film itself, which does not sound like it's fun. I've done a couple of music videos and guys, like even just doing that is really, really, really tough. I was wearing glasses doing one and I couldn't see because my glasses kept fogging up.
Right.
Like, this is not fun. So there's nothing wrong with taking your time right now.
Yeah.
You hear that, other people trying to shoot stuff, get people hurt, take your time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like, having talked to a lot of indie filmmakers, that like, you know, the way that would impact the kind of on-set atmosphere, and it is like that kind of the fun and the kind of communal spirit that like pushes through a lot of stuff in indie films, which are very tough to make. I mean, I've talked to enough directors to know that they're very tough to make, you know, and it's long hours, and it's kind of all hands on deck on indie film, and to have that extra pressure is probably not the best.
Yeah. I can't imagine being an actor and just like looking around at, you know, you're the only one without a mask on. It's like, golly.
Yeah. To try and end on a little bit of a happier note, can you give us a taster in any of the stuff that you're working on in terms of your writing at the moment?
I'm talking with Greg. Greg Sestero right now, and we're thinking about doing this crazy alien paranoia film kind of thing. With Tommy Wiseau and a lot of the usual suspects. But again, it just depends on COVID. But there's a lot of things we can do. And I don't know. I don't want to commit on anything.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. You've given us enough. Yeah, that's totally fine. That's a nice little taster of something. The alien invasion flick with Greg and Tommy. That's great. There's no problem at all, Tyler. It's been great having you on the show. It's been lovely talking to you, and please do come on again anytime you want.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
That was my guest, Tyler, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. As always, I'd also like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest edition of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Unfortunately, that is all for this time, but be sure to join us again next Monday when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!